From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. In the spring of 1990, the women of Claremont, a quiet, sun-drenched neighborhood tucked into the hills of northern San Diego, began locking their doors in ways they never had before, double-checking the deadbolts, calling friends to say they'd arrived home safely, leaving lights burning through the night. They didn't yet have a name for what they feared, but they knew with the particular animal instinct that fear sharpens that something had come among them, something patient, something purposeful, and it was only getting started. The first victim was Alyssa Keller, a 20-year-old who had moved to Claremont looking for the kind of fresh start that San Diego seemed to promise everyone who arrived with hope and a few boxes of belongings. She was found in her apartment on January 12, 1990, stabbed to death. She had not been robbed. There was no sign of forced entry. Whatever had happened to Alyssa Keller, it appeared she had, in some fashion the investigators could not yet explain, let someone in. To understand what followed, it helps to understand who these women were, not as victims, a word that flattens a life into a single terrible moment, but as people. Alyssa Keller was young and optimistic, working and building. Janine Weinhold, 24, was found murdered in her Claremont apartment on February 15, 1990, just weeks after Alyssa. She was described by those who knew her as warm, sociable, the kind of person who made friends easily and trusted that the world was, on balance, a decent place. Holly Tarr, also in her early 20s, was next, killed in September of 1990. Then Pamela Clark, 31, found in November of that same year. Then Tammy Weaver, 22, in January of 1991. And finally, Alyssa's neighbor in the most tragic sense, another young woman making her way in the world, Amber Clark, 27, killed in April of 1991. The San Diego police and the media began calling him the Claremont Killer, though the more tabloid-inclined press would settle on another name. The Lonely Hearts Predator, a phrase that suggested correctly that investigators believed the killer was finding his victims through social contact, at fitness centers, at laundromats, at the small, ordinary crossroads of daily. Six women, all in their 20s and 30s, all living alone or nearly so in apartments within a surprisingly compact geographic cluster in Claremont. All stabbed. All, it appeared, killed by someone they had at least briefly encountered, someone who had crossed their thresholds without triggering an alarm in the split second before everything changed. Life where strangers become brief acquaintances. The investigation that began with Alyssa Keller's death in January 1990 was, from the start, both urgent and frustrating in equal measure. San Diego police detectives worked under a particular pressure that homicide investigators know well. The knowledge that a pattern killer does not stop on his own. Each case that went unsolved was, in a sense, an invitation for another. The department assembled a task force, pulling resources from multiple units, and began the painstaking work of finding threads that connected six separate crime scenes, six separate lives, six separate sets of family and friends, all suddenly broken open with grief. What they found, threading through the evidence, was a profile that was both specific and maddeningly elusive. The killer appeared to target women who lived alone in ground floor or easily accessible apartments. He appeared to be charming enough in initial contact to be admitted, or at least to linger near doorways without raising alarm. The stabbings were not random slashings. They spoke, in the grim language that forensic pathologists speak, of intention and force and proximity. This was someone who came close, someone who stayed close. Investigators believed he was likely a young man, physically fit, and that he was trolling fitness centers and apartment complex common areas as hunting grounds. A theory supported by witness accounts of a man seen speaking with at least some of the victims in the days or hours before their deaths. The case that may have saved additional lives began to break open in the spring of 1991. After the murder of Amber Clark in April. A witness, a woman who had herself encountered a young man near one of the apartment complexes, provided a description that investigators found compelling. And then there was the evidence gathered from the crime scenes themselves. DNA technology, still relatively new to American courtrooms in 1991, but growing in evidentiary weight with each passing year, had yielded biological evidence from several of the crime scenes. That evidence, prosecutors would later argue, pointed to a single individual responsible for the murders. His name was Cleophas Prince Jr. He was 23 years old in 1991, a physically imposing young man who had grown up in Alabama and made his way to San Diego. By multiple accounts in court documents and news reporting, he was sociable, even charming on first encounter, the kind of person who could strike up a conversation at a gym or a complex pool without triggering suspicion. He had been seen, investigators determined, at fitness facilities in the Claremont area. The geographic radius of his life overlapped with what prosecutors would describe as damning specificity, with the geographic radius of six murders. Prince was arrested in May of 1991, not in Claremont but in Birmingham, Alabama. He had left San Diego, a fact that investigators noted with the grim awareness that flight, in these circumstances, carries its own weight. The arrest came after a period of intense investigation, cross-referencing witness descriptions with the DNA evidence that had been collected from the crime scenes. Extradited back to California, Prince was charged with six counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances. The legal architecture in California that makes a defendant eligible for the death penalty. The pretrial period was lengthy and, in legal terms, consequential. Defense attorneys challenged the DNA evidence, a challenge that was not frivolous in 1991 and early 1992, when the science remained newer and more contested in court than it would become in later years. The defense argued about the reliability of the collection, the integrity of the chain of custody, the statistical methods used to interpret the DNA profiles. These were legitimate legal questions, the kind that defense attorneys are obligated by their professional duty to raise, and the courts took them seriously. Ultimately, the trial judge allowed the DNA evidence, ruling it admissible under the standards applicable to California courts. The trial of Cleophas Prince Jr. began in 1993 before San Diego Superior Court Judge Laura Palmer Hams. Deputy District Attorney Woody Clark, who had built a reputation as one of the state's more knowledgeable prosecutors on DNA evidence, led the case for the people. The trial itself was not brief. Prosecutors presented what they described as a convergence of evidence. The DNA profiles linking Prince to multiple crime scenes, witness testimony placing him in proximity to victims in the days before their deaths, and the geographic and behavioral pattern that, they argued, pointed inescapably to a single perpetrator acting with deliberation across a span of 15 months. Prosecutors argued that Prince had identified vulnerable targets, young women living alone in a specific neighborhood, and approached them in the guise of the casual friendliness that urban apartment life sometimes generates between neighbors and near strangers. They argued that he had, in the language of the charging documents and the courtroom, murdered each of these six women with premeditation and deliberation, that each killing was an act of first-degree murder, and that the special circumstances alleged multiple murders made him eligible for the ultimate penalty California law provides. The defense, for its part, contested the reliability of the evidence and challenged the prosecution's interpretation of the witness accounts. Defense attorneys urged the jury to scrutinize the DNA science carefully, to hold the prosecution to its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and to consider whether the case against their client was as airtight as the district attorney's office insisted. It was a vigorous defense, as the Sixth Amendment requires. But in the end, it did not persuade. The jury deliberated and returned verdicts of guilty on all six counts of first-degree murder. The same jury, In the penalty phase that followed under California's bifurcated capital trial process, recommended the sentence of death. Judge Hams imposed that sentence, and Cleophas Prince Jr. was remanded to California's death row at San Quentin State Prison. The community of Claremont and San Diego more broadly received the verdict with the complicated mixture of emotions that such moments produce. There was relief, genuine, palpable relief that a man prosecutors and the jury had found responsible for six murders would not walk free. There was grief, which the verdict did not resolve and could not resolve, for six women whose futures had been taken. And there was something harder to name, the particular exhaustion of a neighborhood that had spent 15 months afraid of its own streets, afraid of the knock on the door, afraid of the smiling stranger in the parking lot. That exhaustion did not simply lift with the verdict, but it began slowly to ease. The case did not end, legally speaking, in 1993. It could not in a capital case. California law and constitutional due process require automatic review of death sentences, and Prince's case entered the long appellate journey that capital convictions invariably undertake. The California Supreme Court, which reviews all death sentences in the state as a matter of law, examined the record in the years that followed. The court affirmed the conviction and the death sentence, finding that the evidence had been sufficient, that the DNA evidence had been properly admitted, and that Prince had received a fair trial. Further habeas proceedings followed. They almost always do in capital cases, and they serve an important function in a system that, when it imposes its most irreversible penalty, has an obligation to be sure. Those proceedings examined, among other things, the evolving science of DNA and whether the standards applied at trial remained valid under subsequent legal and scientific developments. The courts that considered these challenges found them unpersuasive. The conviction and sentence have remained in place. As of the time of this reporting, Cleophas Prince Jr. remains on California's death row. He is among the several hundred individuals sentenced to death in California who have not been executed, in part because California has maintained a de facto moratorium on executions for an extended period. And in 2019, Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order placing an official moratorium on carrying out death sentences while he remained in office. The legal status of California's death penalty has remained a subject of ongoing political and legal debate in the state, and the men and women on San Quentin's death row, now held, after a court-ordered reform effort, under conditions that differ somewhat from the traditional death row model, exist in a kind of legal suspension, their sentences imposed but not carried out. What does not exist in suspension is the record of what happened in Claremont between January 1990 and April 1991. Six women went about the ordinary business of their lives, working, exercising, coming home, making plans, and were killed. Elissa Keller, Janine Weinhold, Holly Tarr, Pamela Clark, Tammy Weaver, Amber Clark. Their names deserve to be said slowly and with the weight they carry. There is a particular cruelty in crimes like these, not just in the violence itself, but in the way they weaponize the ordinary. The gym where you go to feel strong and well. The hallway of your own apartment building. The afternoon when the sun is warm and someone smiles at you and the world seems, for one last moment, simply fine. The women of Claremont had not been careless. They had not been foolish. They had been living, which is the only thing any of us can be accused of. And the investigation that followed, the evidence gathered, the trial conducted, the verdict returned, all of it was, in some sense, an attempt by institutions and communities to insist that their lives mattered, that the law would not look away, that someone would be held accountable. Whether accountability, in the form of a death sentence that has not been and may never be carried out, constitutes justice in any complete sense is a question that each person who considers this case will answer differently, according to their own conscience and their own understanding of what justice is capable of providing. The families of six murdered women have their own answers to that question, answers earned through years of grief and waiting and the peculiar uncertainty of capital litigation. What we can say, with the steadiness that documented fact provides, is this. A jury of 12 Californians heard the evidence, applied the law, and found Cleophas Prince Jr. guilty of 6 murders. The courts that reviewed that finding found it sound. And the 6 women who lost their lives in Claremont are not forgotten, not by their families, not by the investigators who worked their cases, not by a neighborhood that locked its doors in fear and then slowly began to breathe again. The world is not always safe. That is not a comfortable truth, but it is a true one. What communities ask of their institutions, their police departments, their prosecutors, their courts, is not that they make the world perfectly safe, which is beyond any institution's power, but that when the worst happens, someone will look until they find the answer. In San Diego, in the years between 1990 and 1993, they looked, and they found. Our next case takes us to Arlington, Virginia/Richmond, Virginia. There is a moment in any investigation when the ground shifts, when what seemed solid suddenly gives way, and everything investigators thought they understood has to be rebuilt from scratch. In Richmond, Virginia, in the winter of 1987, that moment came not with a confession, not with a witness stepping forward, but with a drop of blood and a strand of science so new that most courtrooms in America had never heard its name. But we are getting ahead of ourselves, because before the science, before the reckoning, there were the women, and their stories deserve to be told first. Debbie Davis was 35 years old, a woman her friends described as warm and quietly determined, someone who had built a life for herself in the Chesterfield County suburbs south of Richmond, with the kind of patient, steady effort that doesn't make headlines but makes a life. She worked. She kept to herself in the way that private people do, and she lived alone in an apartment complex on the kind of ordinary street where nothing extraordinary was supposed to happen. Her neighbor would later tell investigators that Debbie had a laugh you could hear through the walls, not because it was loud, but because it was genuine. She was, by every account, someone who made the small radius of her world a little warmer. Dr. Susan Helms was 32. A neurology resident at the Medical College of Virginia, a woman in the middle of what everyone who knew her recognized as a remarkable life still being built. She had done the hard work of medical school, survived residency's brutal hours, and was moving steadily toward a career in which she would spend her days helping people whose brains had failed them in frightening ways. She was married. She was, her colleagues said, exceptionally gifted. She had decades ahead of her. Diane Cho was 15, a high school student, a daughter. There is very little more that needs to be said about the particular cruelty of that number, except that 15 is an age at which a person is still becoming who they are going to be, and Diane Cho never got to find out. Susan Tucker was 44, living in Arlington, just outside Washington, D.C. She too lived alone. She too was, in the language that investigators and journalists and neighbors reach for in these moments, simply a good person, a woman with friends who loved her, and a life that was hers and no one else's business to take. In the fall and winter of 1987, all 4 of these women were murdered. They were raped and strangled in their own homes, in a terrifying corridor of violence that stretched from the suburbs of Richmond northward to the outskirts of the capital. And from the very beginning, investigators faced a problem that would compound the tragedy in ways that would not fully come to light for months. Because before Timothy Spencer was ever a suspect, there was David Vasquez. Vasquez was a 29-year-old man with a mild intellectual disability who lived in the Richmond area and had a tenuous, circumstantial connection to one of the early crime scenes. In 1984, before the 1987 murders, a woman named Carolyn Hamm had been killed in Arlington in a strikingly similar fashion. Investigators focused on Vasquez. Under questioning, he produced a confused, partially coerced statement that investigators characterized as a confession, though legal observers and defense advocates would later argue strenuously that it bore the hallmarks of a false confession produced by a vulnerable man under pressure. Vasquez pleaded guilty in 1985 to avoid the possibility of the death penalty and was sentenced to prison. The case was, in the eyes of the Arlington County authorities, closed. It was not closed, not even close. When the Richmond murders began in the fall of 1987, investigators from multiple jurisdictions started noticing something that made the ground feel less stable beneath their feet. The cases looked the same. The victims were women living alone. Entry was gained through windows. The method of killing, ligature strangulation, following sexual assault, was consistent across the scenes. And Vasquez, whoever he was, whatever he had or had not done, was sitting in prison when these new women died. State police formed a task force. The FBI's behavioral science unit was consulted. Investigators worked to link the cases and identify a suspect while simultaneously, though perhaps not yet fully consciously, reckoning with the possibility that the man they had sent to prison for Carolyn Hamm's murder might not have been responsible for it at all. The investigation eventually produced a name, Timothy Wilson Spencer. Spencer was 25 years old, a man who had spent portions of his life cycling through the foster care system and who had a prior record for burglary. He worked in the Richmond area and had access to the neighborhoods where the victims lived. Witnesses placed him in proximity to some of the crime scenes. He was, investigators came to believe, the man responsible for all of it. The 1987 Richmond murders and, they suspected, Carolyn Hamm's 1984 killing in Arlington as well. But suspicion is not evidence, and the physical evidence recovered from the crime scenes, biological material collected during the investigations, had, until very recently, been beyond the ability of science to do much with beyond confirm a general blood type. In 1987, that was no longer entirely true. DNA profiling, the forensic application of deoxyribonucleic acid analysis to identify individuals from biological samples, had been developed in the United Kingdom by Dr. Alec Jeffries in 1984. By 1986, it had been used in a British murder case, helping to exonerate an innocent man and identify the actual killer, Colin Pitchfork, in what became a landmark moment in forensic science. In the United States, a private laboratory called LifeCodes Corporation had begun offering DNA forensic analysis services, and a handful of cases were beginning to test whether American courts would accept this new science as admissible evidence. Virginia investigators, working with the FBI and state forensic laboratories, decided to try. Biological evidence recovered from the crime scenes was submitted for DNA analysis. The results, when they came back, were striking. The DNA profile developed from evidence in the murders of Debbie Davis, Susan Helms, Diane Cho, and Susan Tucker all matched one another. They matched one man. And that man, when his own DNA was collected and compared, was Timothy Spencer. Prosecutors in Chesterfield County, where Debbie Davis had lived and died, moved first. Spencer was tried for Davis's murder in the fall of 1988. The DNA evidence was central to the prosecution's case, and the defense challenged it with the full force available, arguing that the science was too new, too untested, too potentially flawed to serve as the basis for a conviction in a capital case. Expert witnesses debated the statistical probabilities, the methodology, the chain of custody. The jury listened. On October 3, 1988, the jury found Timothy Spencer guilty of the capital murder of Debbie Davis. It was the first time in American history that a person had been convicted of a crime based primarily on DNA evidence. The verdict was not just the end of a trial. It was the beginning of a new era in criminal justice. Spencer was subsequently tried and convicted for the murders of Susan Helms and Diane Cho as well. Arlington County prosecutors then tried him for the murder of Susan Tucker, and that conviction carried an additional weight. The evidence in Tucker's case was also analyzed, and compared to the evidence in Carolyn Ham's 1984 murder. The DNA profiles matched. Spencer had killed Carolyn Ham. David Vasquez had not. In January of 1989, Virginia Governor Gerald Baliles granted David Vasquez a full pardon. Vasquez walked out of prison after more than 4 years of incarceration for a crime he had not committed. He was the first person in the United States exonerated through the use of DNA evidence, a milestone that, like the Spencer conviction itself, would reverberate through the American legal system for decades. Spencer's legal proceedings moved through the appeals process with the particular intensity that capital cases demand. His attorneys raised every available challenge to the DNA evidence's admissibility and reliability, to procedural matters at trial, to the constitutionality of his sentence. The Virginia Supreme Court reviewed the cases and affirmed the convictions. Federal habeas corpus petitions were filed and argued. Courts at multiple levels examined the record. None of the appeals succeeded in overturning the verdicts. The courts that reviewed the DNA evidence found that it had been properly admitted and that the methodology, while new, met the legal standards for scientific reliability. The conviction stood. Timothy Spencer was executed by electrocution at the Greensville Correctional Center in Jarrett, Virginia, on April 27, 1994. He was 32 years old. He offered no statement of remorse that the public record preserves. He had been convicted of 4 capital murders. The state of Virginia had determined, and the reviewing courts had affirmed, that those convictions were sound. There is a particular kind of grief that attaches to cases like this one, not a single, clean grief, but something layered and complicated and unwilling to resolve itself neatly. 4 women were murdered. A vulnerable man was wrongly imprisoned. A legal system built on the presumption of innocence failed that presumption in a way that had real, irreversible consequences for a real human being. And then, through the application of a science that barely existed when the first of these crimes was committed, something that looked, at least partially, like justice emerged. Debbie Davis and Susan Helms and Diane Cho and Susan Tucker did not live to see it. Their families carried the losses forward into whatever lives they were able to rebuild, which is always the heaviest part of these stories. The fact that the resolution of a legal case does not resolve the human grief that precedes it. The families of victims do not get their people back when a conviction is affirmed or an execution carried out. They carry absence with them always. David Vasquez carried something different, the particular damage of years taken from him by a system that should have protected him, years spent in a place he should never have been sent, for a crime he had nothing to do with. His exoneration was just, and it was important, and it was not enough. It is never enough, but it mattered, both to him and to the larger story of American law, because Vasquez's case became one of the early, powerful arguments for the systematic use of DNA evidence to review old convictions, an argument that would eventually lead to the Innocence Project and to the exoneration of hundreds of wrongly imprisoned people across the country. The Spencer case is taught in law schools and forensic science programs. It is cited in legal opinions. It is referenced every time someone explains why DNA evidence is now considered a standard tool of criminal investigation. In that sense, the women who were killed and the man who was wrongly imprisoned are woven into the fabric of how the American justice system operates today, whether the people working within that system are always aware of it or not. That is a strange kind of legacy to bear, and it is not the one anyone would have chosen. Debbie Davis deserved to keep laughing through the walls. Susan Helms deserved to finish her residency and have a career and grow old. Diane Cho deserved to find out who she was going to become. Susan Tucker deserved to keep living the life that was entirely her own. None of them agreed to be part of a landmark case. None of them agreed to anything at all. What endures beyond the legal history, beyond the forensic milestone, is the reminder that the purpose of all of it, the science, the courts, the investigations, the decades of procedural refinement, is supposed to be the protection of people, of ordinary, irreplaceable people who deserve to be safe in their own homes, on their own streets, in the lives they have chosen. When the system works as it should, those people are protected. When it fails, as it failed David Vasquez, it must be corrected. When it is confronted with something new, a science it does not yet fully understand, evidence it has never seen before, it must find the courage to learn. In Richmond and in Arlington, in the fall and winter of 1987, the system was confronted with all of those things at once. What emerged from that confrontation changed American law in ways that are still unfolding. What was lost in those apartments, in those homes, in those ordinary places where extraordinary lives were being lived, that cannot be recovered by any science or any verdict or any act of justice, however necessary and however right. It stays lost, and it stays remembered. Our next case takes us to Prairie Village, Kansas. The night sky over Prairie Village, Kansas turned orange sometime after midnight on October 24, 1995. Neighbors on Tomahawk Road who woke to the glow later described a wall of fire consuming the upper story of a handsome two-story home, flames pouring from the windows of the children's bedrooms before anyone could fully process what they were seeing. Fire crews arrived within minutes to find a woman outside, Dr. Deborah Green, a physician herself, and one child, 13-year-old Tim Farrar, who had managed to escape. But there were two more children somewhere inside that house. Two children who had gone to sleep that night in what should have been the safest place in the world. What the firefighters pulled from the wreckage in the hours that followed would set in motion one of the most remarkable criminal investigations in Kansas history. A case that would reveal the fire itself to be only the final act of a slow, methodical campaign of destruction that had been unfolding inside that family for the better part of a year. To understand how a family arrived at that night, you have to understand what that family had been and what it had once promised to become. Michael Farrar was, by every professional measure, a success. A cardiologist practicing in the Kansas City metropolitan area, he was respected among his colleagues and known to his patients as a careful, dedicated physician. He had grown up with modest means, put himself through school by force of will and intelligence, and built a life that most people would have looked at and called the American dream. He was handsome, athletic, and genuinely devoted to his three children, Tim, Kelly, and Kate. Those who knew him described a father who coached Little League, who showed up, who was present in the particular way that busy, accomplished men sometimes are not. Deborah Green was, in many ways, his mirror image. Also a physician, an oncologist, she had trained rigorously, achieving the kind of academic credentials that signaled real intellectual power. Friends from her earlier years remembered her as brilliant, if mercurial, capable of tremendous warmth and, in darker moments, a temper that could fill a room. She and Michael had met during their medical training, married young, and built a life together in the comfortable suburb of Prairie Village, a quiet, prosperous community of well-kept lawns and good schools just south of Kansas City. From the outside, the Farrar household looked like a portrait of upper-middle-class achievement. Two doctors, three children, a large house, a life measured out in school plays and neighborhood block parties. But marriages, as those who have survived difficult ones will tell you, are rarely what they look like from the curb. By the mid-1990s, according to court records and the extensive reporting that followed, the marriage between Michael and Deborah had deteriorated profoundly. Michael, prosecutors would later argue, had become involved with another woman, a colleague named Margaret Hacker, and had told Deborah he wanted a divorce. Deborah, by multiple accounts, was consuming alcohol at alarming levels, her medical career already derailed by professional difficulties related in part to her drinking. The life she had built, the status, the identity, the structure of it, was coming apart. And according to the case that prosecutors would eventually present, Deborah Green's response to that unraveling was not grief or acceptance or even the kind of bitter, messy separation that tears families apart but leaves everyone breathing. Her response, they alleged, was something far more calculated. It began, investigators would come to believe, sometime in the spring of 1995. Michael Farrar started getting sick, not dramatically, not all at once, but in the grinding, cumulative way that baffles physicians because the symptoms don't resolve, because one explanation gives way to another, because a healthy man in his early 40s simply should not feel the way Michael Farrar was feeling. He experienced persistent nausea, vomiting, neurological symptoms, a trembling in his hands, a weakness in his limbs. His own colleagues examined him. Nobody could explain it. He was hospitalized multiple times, underwent testing, was sent home with treatments that didn't hold. And then he would go back to the house on Tomahawk Road and for a period, get better. And then he would get sick again. What Michael Farrar did not know, what he could not have imagined, was that ricin was being added to his food. Ricin is a toxin derived from castor beans, and it is, by any clinical measure, extraordinarily dangerous. In sufficient quantities, it is lethal. In smaller amounts, delivered over time, it produces exactly the kind of bewildering constellation of symptoms that had been plaguing Michael Farrar for months. Prosecutors would allege that Deborah Green had obtained castor beans and produced the poison herself, a ghastly use of a physician's knowledge and access, and had been introducing it into his meals at home with the apparent intention, court records suggested, of killing him and collecting on his life insurance policy. He survived, though the damage to his body was real and lasting. By October 1995, the marriage was in a kind of final crisis. Michael had largely moved out and was staying with Margaret Hacker. The divorce proceedings were underway, which meant, among other things, that a financial settlement was being negotiated and that the comfortable world Deborah Green had known was about to be formally, legally dismantled. The children Tim, 15, Kelly, 13, and Kate, 6, were living primarily with their mother. Just before midnight on October 23rd, the house at 7517 Tomahawk Road caught fire. Tim Farrar, the oldest, woke to the smell of smoke and managed to escape through a window, sustaining burns in the process. He made it to the yard where his mother was already standing. Kelly and Kate did not make it out. Kelly was 13 years old. Kate was 6. They were found in the ruins of the home when the fire was finally contained, and the loss of them is, at the center of this story, a grief beyond any language a narrator can adequately supply. Fire investigators arrived that day, and in the days that followed, and from the beginning, what they found troubled them. The fire showed characteristics consistent with having been deliberately set, multiple points of origin, the use of an accelerant. This was not the signature of an electrical fault or an overturned candle. This had been set, and set in a way that appeared designed to ensure the upper story, where the children slept, would be fully involved before the alarm could be raised. Kansas State Fire investigators worked alongside law enforcement as the scope of the inquiry expanded. Michael Farrar, recovering from yet another mysterious illness, was interviewed and began describing what had been happening to him throughout the year. His medical records were subpoenaed. His treating physicians were interviewed. And then investigators began looking at the question that the circumstantial evidence was increasingly insisting they look at. Had someone been deliberately making Michael Farrar sick? The toxicological analysis that followed was painstaking. Forensic experts examined biological samples, examined the pattern of his illness, examined its timing relative to his absences from the home. The periods when he was with Hacker, when he reliably improved, and the returns to Tomahawk Road, when he reliably deteriorated. The evidence, prosecutors would later argue, pointed unmistakably toward ricin poisoning, a conclusion that, when it emerged publicly, sent a particular chill through the medical community. Here was a physician, the argument went, who had turned her clinical training against the man she had married. Deborah Green was identified as the sole suspect. She was charged in 1996 with two counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Kelly and Kate Farrar, and with aggravated arson. Additionally, charges related to the poisoning of Michael Farrar, charges alleging attempted murder, were part of the legal proceedings that unfolded. The case presented to the court, drawn from months of investigative work, rested on several pillars. There was the fire investigation itself, with its evidence of deliberate origin. There was the pattern of Michael Farrar's illness and the toxicological findings that pointed toward ricin as the cause. There was Tim Farrar's account of that night, a teenager who had survived to describe what he had experienced, and there was the financial and personal context, the pending divorce, the life insurance policy, the documented deterioration of the marriage. Deborah Green, through her attorneys, did not go to trial. In January 1996, she entered a plea of no contest to two counts of second-degree murder, one for each of her daughters who died in that fire, and to charges of aggravated arson. In Kansas, a plea of no contest carries the same legal weight as a guilty plea for sentencing purposes, though it does not constitute an admission of guilt. The distinction matters legally. What matters practically is what the court then did. She was sentenced to 40 years in prison with the possibility of parole, a sentence that reflected the magnitude of what the court found had occurred. The judge's remarks at sentencing, widely reported at the time, acknowledged the layers of tragedy embedded in the case. The deaths of two children, the survival of a third who would carry that night for the rest of his life, and the comprehensive ruin of a family that had, at some earlier point, represented something real and hopeful. Appeals followed over the subsequent years, as they do in cases of this severity. Deborah Green's legal team raised various challenges to the proceedings, to the evidence, to aspects of the investigation and the plea process. The Kansas courts reviewed those challenges, and the conviction was upheld. As of the most recent public records available, Deborah Green remains incarcerated, serving her 40-year sentence. Tim Farrar, the boy who escaped through a window at 15 years old, grew up in the long shadow of that night, a shadow that no amount of time can fully lift. Michael Farrar, who survived the poisoning, rebuilt something of a life. He and Margaret Hacker eventually married, though the word rebuilt is always inadequate when measured against what was lost. Rule, who had a particular gift for rendering the human architecture of cases that defied easy explanation, for asking not just what happened, but how two educated, accomplished people arrived at catastrophe, brought the Farrar case to a national readership, and ensured that Kelly and Kate Farrar, who might otherwise have been reduced to footnotes in legal documents, were. Rule's account, based on extensive interviews and the documentary record, grappled with the question that the case poses most insistently. How does a physician, someone who trained for years to heal, who took an oath to do no harm, arrive at the decision, if indeed it was a decision in the deliberate sense, to poison a husband and set a fire in a house where her children? The case entered the broader public consciousness in 1997 when Ann Rule, the true crime writer whose credentials included personal friendship with Ted Bundy and a decades-long career illuminating the dark corners of American violence, published her account titled Bitter Harvest, remembered as the children they were. Slept. The answers Rule found were not simple, because simple answers are almost never honest ones. There was the alcohol and what it had done to Deborah Green's capacity for judgment. There was the accumulating humiliation of a life dismantling itself, the career faltering, the marriage ending, the identity she had constructed over decades crumbling. There was, by the accounting of those who studied the case most closely, a kind of dissociation from consequence that can emerge in people under extreme psychological pressure, a state in which the ordinary guardrails of human empathy appear to fail entirely. None of that explains. Explanation is not exculpation, and the facts of the case, adjudicated in a court of law, acknowledged through a no-contest plea, are what they are. Kelly Farrar was 13 years old. K. Kate Farrar was 6. They went to sleep in their beds on a Tuesday night in October, in a house in a quiet Kansas suburb, and they did not wake up. What stays with you in a case like this is not the toxicology or the fire investigation or even the courtroom proceedings, as important as all of those things are. What stays with you is the particular cruelty of the gap between what that family was supposed to be and what it became. 2 physicians, 3 children, a house full of books and homework, and the ordinary noise of a family moving through its days. And then the orange sky at midnight, and the neighbors standing on the lawn, and Tim Farrar with burns on his hands, and the silence where 2 little girls used to be. Prairie Village is still a quiet suburb. The houses on Tomahawk Road still have neat lawns and good school districts, and all the visible furniture of a comfortable life. There is nothing about the street now that would tell a stranger what happened there on the night of October 24, 1995, and in some ways that is as it should be, the ordinary world reasserting itself as it always does over the sites of extraordinary sorrow. But the story is still there. The legal record is still there, and Kelly and Kate Farrar are still gone. That's 3 cases for today. From all of us at Intellijix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.